for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Robert Wright has taught philosophy at Princeton, psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. He writes on a wide range of issues related to technology, religion, foreign policy, and terrorism. In his latest book, titled The Evolution of God, he examines the history of religion to determine how, if at all, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam can get along in the modern world. Robert Wright joins me in the studio for a discussion of religion in an age of advanced science and rapid globalization. We do invite your questions and comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you. It's good to have you
here. Good morning. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I gather that you are used to being controversial. You've written things that have challenged people's thinking. Read for us those first two paragraphs of your book, if you would.
Okay, sure. It's very flattering to be asked to read from my book. This is from the introduction. I was once denounced from the pulpit of my mother's church. The year was 1994. My book, The Moral Animal, had just been published, and I'd been lucky enough to have it excerpted in Time magazine. The excerpt was about the various ways in which our evolved human nature complicates the project of marriage. One such complication is the natural, universally human temptation to stray, and that is the angle Time's editors chose to feature on the magazine's cover. Alongside a stark image of a broken wedding band were the words, "Infidelity, it may be in our genes." The pastor of the First Baptist Church in Santa Rosa, California, saw this article as a godless defense of philandering and said so one Sunday morning. After the service, my mother went forward and told him that her son was the author of the article. "I'm willing to bet that. Such are the wonders of maternal love," she said it with pride.
Robert Wright, and his new book is titled The Evolution of God. Now, if you can explain the idea of putting evolution and God into a single sentence for us, I realize you took a whole book to do that, but see if you can help us understand that.
One sentence. Okay, well, ideas like biological species evolve, and our ideas about God have evolved over time, and that's the story I try to tell in the book.
How have our ideas about God evolved?
Well, 20,000 years ago, so far as we can tell, the world was populated by hunter-gatherer societies, and every one of them believed in multiple gods. They were polytheistic. And it seems to be the case that their religion had nothing to do with morality, something we associate with religion today. So in other words, it wasn't about keeping people from lying or cheating or stealing. It wasn't about that. And yet, over time, for much of the world, religion has come to be about the worship of a single god and has become very much infused with morality. So that's an example of one of the trends over time that I wanted to trace and try to explain in telling the story of the evolution of ideas about God.
And so morality, the idea of morality, is one of the huge issues at the center of the evolution of our ideas about God.
Yes, really in a couple of senses. I mean, first, religion.
But wasn't he there right at the start of the book of Genesis? Wasn't he saying to Adam, "You may not touch that apple, and if you do,
yeah,
this is what's going to happen.
Well, yes. By the time the story moves to ancient Israel, and most of the book is about the Abrahamic God, the God of Christians, Jews, and Muslims. I trace him through the emergence of monotheism in ancient Israel, the emergence of Christianity, the emergence of Islam. And by the time you get to that part of the story, religion has come to be about morality in throughout the Middle East, not just in Israel, but really as soon as societies got large and complex in the ancient world, moral regulation became kind of a challenge, and religion seems to have played that role. So by the time the story of the Abrahamic God begins, it's very much about morality. And there's the related question of, you might say, God's own morality. In other words, sometimes to our eyes, to look at the scripture, sometimes the Abrahamic God seems like a very bad God, advocating the annihilation of whole cities of people because they don't believe in him. Sometimes he seems to be a God of compassion and even broad compassion, sometimes extending beyond the bounds of his worshipers. And one thing I was interested in is in the course of the book trying to figure out what circumstances gave rise to a benevolent God and what circumstances gave rise to a more belligerent, angry God.
Are you talking about the evolution of religion, or are you talking about the evolution of God?
Well, I guess for the first few chapters, it's more about religion because I'm trying to tell the story of how you get from a polytheistic world to, in the Middle East, a monotheistic world. And it's very much about how the role of religion changes, even though there are all kinds of gods, floating around. So there's no one god whose biography you can follow. But then once after a few chapters, the story picks up the Abrahamic God, then increasingly it's the biography of the God that we in the Western world know.
And the God we know now, how has that God that we understand to be God, how has that God been affected by the world we see today?
It depends on which set of believers you ask. And one point of the book is that, sometimes people ask about Islam or other religions, is such and such a religion of peace, or is it a religion of war? And a big point of the book is that that's, I think, not the right question, because any religion at a given point in time may be either, and any religion may be both, depending on which followers you ask. And in the modern world, I think we're seeing God having very much a split personality. There are radicals who want God to be a God of hatred and belligerence. There are moderates who want God to be a God of universal compassion. And the key question is what makes the difference? What circumstances steer people in one direction or another in interpreting God's will? I addressed that question. That was one of the main questions motivating the book, but I address it largely in an historical context. So I look at the scriptures themselves, the belligerent ones, the tolerant ones, and ask, what circumstances gave rise to those two kinds of scriptures?
It's so fascinating that you're here today when the Episcopal Church yesterday made the decision to accept homosexuals as bishops of the church. Now, some people are going to argue that that's going to further divide the Episcopalians in this country and have those become more conservative, and others, the more liberal group that has already made this decision, will go its own way. That's part of the evolutionary process.
And I would say that the people who are in favor of a more liberal attitude toward homosexuals are by and large people who have been not just exposed to homosexuals in their social lives, but in a congenial environment. In other words, when you encounter people and it looks as if you can benefit through cooperation with them, friendship with them, collaboration with them, I think you will find in your religion a basis for tolerance. Whereas if for whatever reason you find them some kind of threat to you, then you're going to start looking for a basis for intolerance. And you can find either in the scriptures. The scriptures of all three Abrahamic religions have their belligerent, their intolerant passages, have their benevolent, their tolerant passages. And I think it's a question of what kinds of circumstances people find themselves in.
It's also a question of what moves the evolutionary process forward.
Mm-hmm.
The tolerant, the more liberal, the more open-minded, or the more conservative.
That's right. And I would guess that on the tolerant side, in this particular debate, you're talking about people who live in a more cosmopolitan milieu, where they encounter lots of different kinds of people, but this story I think goes way back. In the book I talk about a transition in God, an abrupt transition in God's character, coming in the history of Judaism, when. Before the exile, the Babylonian exile, the Jews have been in a very hostile environment where their neighbors are very adversarial. Israel has been attacked a lot, and then it culminates in this humiliating exile to Babylon when they're conquered by the Babylonians. And I argue that there you have a God of belligerence. And afterwards, when they're in the Persian Empire and surrounded by fellow members of the empire who are not threats to them, I think you see God assume a very different character.
Robert Wright, his new book is titled The Evolution of God. Our lines are filled, so if you're trying to call us now on 800-433-8850, I'd hold off for a few moments. We're getting email drshow@wamu.org. And here's our first email from Mark, Bob Wright. He says, because everything evolves, including the idea of God, then it can be surmised that God is an evolutionary rule.
That God is an evolutionary rule. Belief in God certainly starts out as a universal thing. I'm not exactly sure what the emailer is getting at, but I would say that there is a pattern in the evolution of God as I see it. And that is to say that on balance, we've been talking about what brings out the tolerance in God and what brings out the intolerance. On balance, God has moved toward broader tolerance. God as understood, the Abrahamic God as understood by worshipers, has moved toward a greater tolerance. So I do believe that, and I think that is a result of the basic kind of dynamics behind the evolution. So I think there are rules you can see in the evolution of God. I think there's a pattern in the evolution of God, and I think it's an encouraging one.
Describe that pattern.
Well, my basic argument about the moods of God And they just fluctuate wildly in both the Quran and the Bible. You know, one minute, you know, God is advising believers to basically say, you've got your religion, we've got ours. At another moment, advising believers to annihilate infidels. This is in both the Bible and the Quran. And I think the basic pattern is when believers see another group of people who are outside their circle, but see that they can do business with them or can benefit from peaceful coexistence and do not feel threatened by them, they interpret God's will benignly. And when they feel threatened materially or feel their values threatened, it's the opposite. And the encouraging thing about the basic trend in the development of the world is that as social organization has expanded, starting off with hunter-gatherer societies, and now so far culminating in a globalized world, what you see is you see relationships of interdependence spread so that, you know, our fate right now is intertwined with the fates of people around the world.
Of course.
They make goods for us. We're in the same boat in terms of the environment, the economy. And my argument is that now, as in ancient times, when people see themselves in the same boat as other people, when they really get the picture, not just that it's the case that they're in the same boat, but when they understand it, then they tend to find the tolerance. So if this kind of interdependence with people is the secret ingredient of tolerance, even if it takes some cultivating sometimes to get it to really work, then I think it's encouraging that the basic trend of social evolution has been toward vaster and vaster interdependence, and I think that's what we have to take advantage of.
But before we reach that point, you talk in the book about the various clashes that do go on, and of course you culminate with the clash between science and religion.
Right.
But before you get there, what are the other clashes at work?
Oh, they're fairly constant. I mean, take Muhammad, for example, in the Quran. And that's the Quran is an example of a story that I think becomes very clear once you start reading the verses in the order in which they actually took shape. Because the Quran, like the Bible, does not appear in the order in which the verses actually took shape. But once you kind of sort that out and use the kind of scholarly consensus on in the case of the Quran, when these verses were uttered by Muhammad, you see that, you know, there are times when Muhammad, he seems to start trying to bring Christians and Jews on board in a common Abrahamic faith. So he thinks he can gain through interaction with them. He thinks he can play this win-win game with them. And predictably, he says these wonderfully nice things about them. He says Jesus is the Spirit of God. Jesus is the Word of God. He says God chose the Hebrews above all other people in his prescience. And he even has Muslims observing Yom Kippur, apparently, and praying toward Jerusalem. This is in the beginning, when he thinks he can play a win-win game. When he concludes, apparently, that it's not going to work, that whether the Christians and Jews don't want to come on board or whatever, we don't know exactly. But once he decides he's playing a zero-sum game with them, in other words, they're not going to both win, it's not going to be a win-win outcome, then that's when you get the verses that are hostile toward Christians and Jews. And, you know, you could tell a similar story about the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament even. It's a kind of a vacillation between clashes and hostility and exactly the kinds of scriptures that naturally brings and the more congenial times. On balance, I think the direction has been a positive one, but there's always backsliding, and there is that in the world today.
I want to go back to this issue of morality and when you saw morality evolve into our picture of God.
You actually start seeing this. I have a chapter on chiefdoms early on. Chiefdoms it's a term that anthropologists use for societies after the invention of agriculture. So society moves from like hunter-gatherer village to these things called chiefdoms. And they're pretty complex. They have multiple villages. And, you know, we've observed a certain number of chiefdoms in the last couple of centuries. So although these aren't the exact chiefdoms that existed you know, 10,000, 8,000 years ago, they give us a general idea. And there you see, in, for example, the Polynesian chiefdoms that we've observed, you see religion starting to play a role in maintaining a moral code. So in some Polynesian islands, there was the idea that if you stole things, then when you went swimming in the ocean, the gods would see to it that you were eaten by a shark. Okay, so you start getting you start getting disincentives for doing bad things and incentives for doing good things. That's not part of religion originally, back in the hunter-gatherer stage, apparently. But as soon as societies get kind of complex, that enters in and it becomes more and more refined as you move toward the kind of ancient state level, the context in which ancient Israel's God takes shape.
And what about evil? Is that a product of modern religion?
You mean the idea of evil?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you take evil, that's a word that's used kind of casually. I think what it should mean in its kind of classic context is the idea that there is a single source behind all the bad. Is, you know, sometimes people use evil to mean just really, really bad, but I think classically it means that there is a single source behind all the evil in the world. And that you don't start to get until ancient states, really pretty close to the time of ancient Israel. Zoroastrian is kind of dualistic. Zoroastrianism of Persia is kind of dualistic in that way. And that may have influenced Israelite religion. But that's a fairly recent development. And then you have offshoots of Christianity that are very dualistic. This Christian Marcion thought that the God of the Old Testament was the source of bad, and that that the God that Jesus announced was a good God, and those two had done battle. But this kind of dualism or monocheism, and that's another example of it, is you know, relatively recent.
Robert Wright, he is a senior fellow at the New America Foundation. He's taught in the philosophy department of Princeton University and the psychology department at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is titled The Evolution of God. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Before we open the phones, tell me about your own belief system.
Okay. Well, first of all, I was raised a Southern Baptist, so I was very, conscious of the idea of God at a very early age in a pretty intense way. I'm not a Christian now, but I'm not an atheist. I do think there is evidence that there is some larger purpose unfolding through the workings of nature, and I stress through the workings of nature. I'm not talking about some mystical force intervening or anything.
Nature defined how?
Well, I would say beginning with biological evolution and continuing in this thing that we've been talking about called cultural evolution, the evolution of human society and human ideas. I think you see a direction in both of those that, on the one hand, can be explained by the kind of material workings of nature, but on the other hand, causes you to ask yourself, well, is it possible that the material system was set in motion to realize some end or some purpose? I think there's a moral direction to human cultural evolution. I think it naturally moves us, you know, fitfully, for sure, with backsliding, but moves us closer to the moral truth that people everywhere are people and deserve respect. We take that belief for granted now, but it was not always a common belief on this planet. I think we've kind of somewhat naturally moved toward that belief. I also think that biological evolution was very likely to create intelligent beings. They weren't necessarily going to look like us, but I think some sort of human level of intelligence was very likely. And I think when you put the picture together, it's not at all implausible that some sort of larger purpose unfolding. That doesn't mean that there's a God behind it. Could be. But I would go so far as to say that there's a I think there's evidence of a larger purpose that has a moral direction and helps me orient my life.
How?
Well, it gives me, first of all, I like, and you know, people are different in terms of what gives them spiritual sustenance. You know, it's like some people say, a lot of people are looking for a source of spiritual sustenance in an age where maybe they don't think they can believe in the old-fashioned personal kind of God. And some people say like, well, we're made of the same stuff that stars are made of. We're made of stardust. And that makes me feel a lot better. Well, Diane, I have to tell you, that really doesn't make me feel better. But whatever works. For me, it actually helps to think that there is a larger purpose with a moral direction that you can be part of and conscious of and try to further in your everyday life.
But how can there be? Are we in a period of backsliding?
In some ways, yes. I mean, you can point to signs of progress and you can absolutely point to signs of a backsliding. It's always been that way. I think on balance, the moral direction of human development has been positive, but I think that the one point I was trying to drive home in the book is that looking at the history of these three Abrahamic religions gives us some idea of how to go about bringing out the best in religion today. And I think I wrote a piece about this for the Huffington Post a few weeks ago. I think Barack Obama, not from having read the book, sorry to say, but just naturally kind
of... You never know.
Well, I should be so lucky, but... I think he naturally gets the moral of the story, as I see it. You know, in his Cairo speech, when he's emphasizing the importance of expressing respect for Muslims, when he's trying to get the settlement activity to stop, he understands that if people don't feel their values are threatened, that they're disrespected, if they don't feel materially threatened, you're more likely to see the moderate part of their religion emerge.
At 26 before the hour. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm sure our callers have many questions for you at 800-433-8850. Let's go first to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, James. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I love your show.
Thank you.
My question for the author is, how can he reconcile the overall moral tone of the 600-plus laws presented in the Leviticus of the Bible with a God that he calls belligerent and angry?
Well, it's by the way, I went to high school in San Antonio, so give the city my regards. But it's not hard to point to episodes of belligerence in the Hebrew Bible or what Christians call the Old Testament. In Deuteronomy, there's a passage where God instructs the Israelites to annihilate nearby cities and expressly says, do not leave anything alive that breathes, including livestock, not to mention women and children, because they have the wrong religion. So there's no, and there are other that's the worst episode, but there are other ones. On the other hand, there are times when the Israelites say to a neighbor that worships another god, they not only advocate peaceful coexistence, but invoke the name of this other god. They say, you've got your god Chemosh, we've got our god Yahweh, can't we get along? So you see, both of these things, there's no doubt that they're there. The fact that they're contradictory just underscores my point that the God of the Bible and the Quran is a God of massive mood fluctuations. And if we can understand the source of the fluctuations, maybe we can make things better.
When you say understand the source of the fluctuations, what you're talking about seems to me is the political world around that era or that epoch, and that's what creates those fluctuations.
Very much.
And that evolution is what's happening on Earth.
It's very much, in my view, about politics and economics, The passage I just mentioned in Deuteronomy is part of the description in my book of how monotheism emerges. This passage seems to date to King Josiah, who was, first of all, apparently bent on conquest, and that explains the one verse I just alluded to, the belligerent one. But he was also bent on wiping out domestic political rivals, and that seems to be a key reason that he emphasized the worship of Yahweh and Yahweh alone, because the prophets...
One God.
Because the prophets... The evidence in the Bible of polytheism in Israel is very clear. When he goes into the temple, Josiah does a house cleaning of the temple, wiping out gods. He goes in, he finds Asherah, who apparently was a goddess, who was either a wife or consort of the God of Israel. He wipes these gods out because they are a threat to him politically.
Robert Wright, his book, The Evolution of God. We'll take more of your calls when we come back. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, two comics who are good friends and get on each other's nerves. We talk with Michael Ian Black and Michael Showalter, the creators and stars of the new Comedy Central series, Michael and Michael Have Issues. They were also in the MTV sketch comedy series, The State, which just came out on DVD. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Have an email now for Robert Wright on his book, The Evolution of God. Here's an email from Doug, who's listening on WUOM in Warren, Michigan. He says, religion and God are creations of man. They are memes, much like language. The morality in the Old Testament is not what we consider morality today. The New Testaments were written between 1 and 300 years after the supposed death of a Christ figure. Many of the Christian celebrations, like Christmas and Easter, were taken from pagan religions. Non-believers were murdered as a means of controlling the people. Today, atheism is the fastest-growing belief system in the world. People all over the world are starting to believe in reason and science.
Well, yeah, I'm all for reason and science. And any spiritual belief system I'm going to have is going to have to be compatible with them. But I think there are such belief systems. Now, it's certainly true that you can look at the Bible and see a lot of things that strike us as abhorrent. In a way, that's my point when I talk about the basic trend of positive moral direction, is these things were commonplace. Nobody batted an eye when you advocated genocide back then. And now we do. So that is evidence that there's been progress and raises the question of whether that's part of some larger purpose. But I certainly agree that any theory about the purpose, any spiritual belief system is going to have to be compatible with science. And I treat that a little in the book. In fact, there's an afterword word called, by the way, What is God? That's available online in full at evolutionofgod.net, where I talk about whether belief in God can be compatible, is intellectually viable in the modern world. And I think you have to carefully qualify what you mean by God. And I'm certainly not saying I'm sure there is a God, but I think the answer to the question, as I put it, is yes.
Now, how did your own belief system evolve after those beginnings as a Southern Baptist?
Well, I mean, first I ceased to be a Christian largely because of, I guess, the theory of natural selection. I mean, I came from a kind of a creationist background, so there seemed to be a stark incompatibility there. So I fell away from that faith, and I do not subscribe to any of the claims of divine revelation in any of the three Abrahamic faiths. I mean, my book is in that sense told, the story is told from a skeptical stance and emphasizes just kind of continuous evolution and material factors on the ground. Now, in my own life, I've gotten a little interested in Buddhism. I mean, I guess you could say a fairly secular version of it, but even a fairly secular version of Buddhism believes in a transcendent source of meaning, you might say. It believes there is moral truth out there, and your job is to align yourself with it. And I did a one-week meditation retreat.
Where was this?
It's a place called the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, B-A-R-R-E. This was about 6 years ago, and it was really transformative. I wish I could say it was permanently transformative. Alas, you know, 3 days after it, I was kind of a jerk again. But it really was. By the end of the retreat, I had a completely different perspective that was much less self-centered, much less judgmental of other people. I mean, massively less judgmental. It was really a transformation of consciousness, and I think that was a movement toward the objective truth. Okay, I think, you know, I've written about evolutionary psychology. I wrote a book called The Moral Animal, and that convinced me that natural selection has, you know, designed the mind for a fairly arbitrary, you know, set of, I mean, it designed the mind to get genes into the next generation, okay? And in order to get genes into the next generation, you focus on a bunch of things that aren't necessarily very closely connected with ultimate truth. So the mind, as it naturally leads us through life, is not necessarily a reliable guide to truth. And I thought that at the end of that week, I was closer to the objective truth about other human beings in the world than at the beginning of the week.
But it wore off.
Well, it wore off because I wasn't very good about sustaining the discipline of meditating every day. But at the same time, it left a permanent mark. You know, it was a kind of a proof for me that a higher form of consciousness is in principle available, and a reminder to me that the consciousness we have every day when we're going around making these judgments about people based on whether they are or are not threats to us is not really a valid way to look at things.
All right. To Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning, Cal.
Good morning, Diane. And good morning, Mr. Wright.
Good morning.
I think that your book should be subtitled God Without God, The New Gnosticism, because that is exactly what you are purporting. I am very, very happy that you were able to finish your book, but I'm trying to find out what your essential point is, because the lack of clarity that you have when you say that God has, if I might describe how you said it, God has mood swings which underlie the fluctuations of progress of history and that we should learn to propitiate this God, quote-unquote, as you describe, so that that won't happen. Well, that is such a narrow, unfocused understanding of the Bible, not to mention that the concept of what a Jew is and what a Muslim are, Abraham versus Muhammad, is extremely different. And I think that you really, really are doing a disservice by purporting to say anything. And I'm a Southern Baptist as well, who's interested in the depths of philosophy, and this is just a new Gnosticism.
All right, Cal, thanks for your call.
Well, I do not expect to be embraced by a lot of believing Christians, Jews, and Muslims. The book is not told from the standpoint of a believer, and I'm not a believer. I've gotten a good reaction from, I guess you could say, some theologically liberal Christians. I don't know what I can say, except that I'm not surprised.
If I can try to put in a nutshell what you have done here, and then you take it and expand on it. Seems to me what you're saying in your book, The Evolution of God, is that somehow in man's minds, God has been explained in many different ways, and the theory, the idea, the notion of God has evolved because of what happens in the real world.
Right. And that doesn't preclude, you're right, I'm viewing belief in God as starting out as really a set of illusions. I mean, the hunter-gatherers were trying to come up with explanations of why bad things happen and why good things happen, storms and droughts and disease and victory and war and loss and war. And they came up with these gods, fundamentally illusions. Then the illusions were transformed over time in an evolutionary process. And that doesn't sound like a flattering depiction of any of the gods that we had along the way if they were derived from illusions. But I am leaving open the possibility that this evolution of thought could move toward a less and less illusory conception of transcendent meaning and even of something that merits the term divine. Now, at the same time, it would be, I think, a little lacking in humility for us to think that we've gotten to the answer yet, or we've gotten to an answer that's sufficiently refined to not need further refinement. Contemporary conventional believers feel that they got it right, but all the people before them didn't. And I think maybe we should be a little more open to the prospect for further evolution.
All right. To Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Neil.
Hello. My point is, I have a couple, but I'll do a quick one first, which is that the title is, I think, a little misleading because Mr. Wright is really talking not about the evolution of God, but the evolution of belief in God or definitions of God. And it's a little bit unfortunate because he's using evolution then in a way which may not have much bearing on evolution as it's understood in a biological context. Because that's a very technically rigorous definition of evolution, and it's not just anything that changes with time.
Well, yes. When I called the book The Evolution of God, I was very mindful of that. I mean, there's a whole controversy we shouldn't get bogged down in about the extent to which it's intellectually valid to talk about cultural evolution. I would just quickly point out that a lot of anthropologists do it, and also that Richard Dawkins, whose credentials as an evolutionary biologist I doubt you will indict, the last chapter of his classic book, The Selfish Gene, is called Memes, The New Replicators.
I'm not a big fan of Dawkins.
Well, but he's certainly a biologist. Anyway, you're right. There's a controversy, and I should just emphasize that cultural evolution is very different from biological evolution in many ways, and I talk about that in the book. I still think the idea is useful enough to illuminate the history of God and what God means to us today.
The other point, if I...
Sure.
In one of your previous books, you began this idea about the direction of evolution. And I think your argument is flawed because you don't distinguish between the maximum complexity of organisms and the range of complexity and the average complexity. So, I mean, you observe, without being a biologist, that there are more complex organisms around now than there might have been, 2.5 billion years ago. But what you may not be as fully cognizant of as practicing biologists is that along with every new organism, there is a host, and that's sort of a pun, I guess, of parasites, which are less complex.
Sure.
Viruses, et cetera. So I think your fundamental idea, I mean, you are correct that there is a pattern which can be seen, but I would disagree with you that it's as clear as you suggest or that it's necessarily irreversible. And quite frankly, due to events beyond biology, if the sun blows up or whatever, the direction of evolutionary complexity will reverse very quickly.
I mean, the question isn't really about this book, but it's not irrelevant to this book because you're asking about whether there are trends in biological evolution. And my only point, which is not incompatible with anything you've said, is that if you ask yourself at any given point in biological evolution, what is the most complex organism right now? And what is the most intelligent organism right now? That has tended to grow through biological evolution for intelligible reasons. I think that's why actually the evolution of an intelligent species, maybe not like us, was likely. And that's relevant to the question of whether there's any sort of direction and larger purpose at work through natural selection. So it's not irrelevant to the question of God, but it's not fundamentally about this book.
Neil, thanks for your call at 7 minutes before the hour. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email. Simple question. Does God exist or is God a creation of humans?
Well, I think God is certainly a creation of humans. I don't think that precludes the possibility that something that merits the term divine exists. I think it's unlikely that God is anything like what we've been able to conceive, if God exists, but not like the God depicted in the Bible, probably. In other words, a personal God. On the other hand, the human mind is not designed to conceive things like this. Even in science, we're realizing that things like electrons are perhaps just literally not conceivable by the human mind. When we try to draw a picture of them or think, is it a particle? Is it a wave? Is it neither or both? We're beset by contradictions. Even though we have a mathematical system for describing electrons that helps us build computers and stuff, it works, but it seems that we've reached kind of the limits of human cognition. And scientists say, believing in electrons, so to speak, has pragmatic value, and there's some sense in which it's valid, even though we know we're not thinking about them clearly, in a sense.
Now, so are you then drawing the ideas of religion and science closer together?
In this afterword I talked about that's online, I draw that comparison. And it's, speculative, but it's interesting to me the possibility that even if God is not a personal God, belief in a personal God could be intellectually valid in somewhat the sense that belief in an electron is, because because there is something there, and there is a source of what I call the moral order in the universe, and conceiving of it, however imperfectly, has certain pragmatic value, like helping you live a moral life, helping you more closely approximate the moral axis of the universe. So I don't know if it's too strained an analogy, but people can judge. It's at evolutionofgod.net. It's called, by the way, What is God? It's the afterword. And I do think science has brought us in touch with the limits of human cognition in a way that should instill some humility in us when we think about philosophical and ultimate questions as well as scientific questions.
And you talk about President Obama as having come along here at this particular time in history. What significance do you draw?
Well, I think, first of all, he is, by virtue of background, well-positioned to see Americans the way Americans may not naturally see themselves. He he's able to put himself in the shoes of people in different cultures. And I argue in the book, I call this moral imagination, when you can put yourself in the shoes of somebody in very different circumstances. And I argue that religions have tended to, on balance, expand the moral imagination. And they've done so because our social survival, the ongoing cohesion of societies, depends on that expansion. And that's the big challenge now, and that I do think he's well positioned to help us make progress.
Robert Wright. His new book is titled The Evolution of God. You've given us all lots to think about.
Well, thanks. It's really been a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.